I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Even though you may not be feeling it, the U.S. is a bright star in the global economy. Unemployment is at its lowest rate in 6 years. The GDP is growing. Consumers are spending. Manufacturing is showing some signs of life. And the dollar is getting stronger. In fact, the dollar is viewed as safer than the currencies of other countries. By contrast, there's a debt crisis in the eurozone. The Russian economy has been hit hard by sanctions and falling oil prices. China's growth is slowing down, and Japan is in a slump. And since we live in a global economy, we have to know about and we have to care about what's happening in the rest of the world. So today on Radio Times, we'll explore some of the twists and turns of the global economy, why the U.S. recovery is more robust than other countries, and what it all means for average Americans. And we have two guests who have joined us. Joining us from the Brookings Institution is Eshwar Prasad. He's a professor of trade policy at Cornell University, a senior fellow at Brookings, and his latest book is called The Dollar Trap, How the U.S. Dollar tighten its grip on global finance. And Eshwar Prasad, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. And let me introduce our guest here in our Philadelphia studio is Mauro Guillem. He's the director of the Joseph H. Lauder Institute at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's also a professor in international management at the Wharton School, co-wrote a book called Global Turning Points. And Mauro Guillem, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Let me begin with a kind of a global question, and I'll put this to you, Mauro. And even going back to the financial crisis of, 2008, 2009, were pretty much the countries we're talking about today, were they pretty much all hit hard the same way by the financial implosion?
Well, absolutely not. Back in 2008, 2009, the emerging economies didn't suffer as much. There was a decline in trade, but they adjusted quite well to that, especially by boosting domestic consumption and especially investment at that time. So the areas that were hardest hit were clearly Europe, both Western and Eastern Europe, and the United States.
Do you see, and I'll toss this to you, Eshwar, when you look at the U.S. economy, what are the bright signs that you see?
Now, the U.S., Marty, is a fundamentally dynamic and resilient economy, and although the global financial crisis did have its origins here, what is important is that we had on the front lines policymakers who had learned from the lessons of the past, including Ben Bernanke, who was a scholar of the Great Depression. And what the U.S. did was to very aggressively use both fiscal policy and monetary policy through easy money in order to put the economy back on its feet. So this combination, I think, is what has put the U.S. economy ahead of the other advanced economies. Now, I should note that during the global financial crisis, while the advanced economies, as Mauro correctly pointed out, were generally hit, the emerging market economies such as China, Brazil, India actually pulled through the initial stages of the financial crisis relatively well, although some of them are now facing some tensions of their own.
And we will get back and pick up on all of that. Let me go back to you, Mauro, because yesterday we did a program about the wage stagnation in this country, especially as it applies to, broadly speaking, the middle class. Do you see that as a serious drag on the U.S. economy and even on the American dream, if I can put it that way?
Well, it is quite clear that in past recessions here in the United States, the economy has recovered more swiftly. Because consumption by the middle class recovered relatively quickly. This is not happening at the same pace this time around. And in fact, we see that global projections for the next 10 or 15 years in terms of growth of middle class consumption put the United States in more or less a stagnant position, whereas in Asia, South Asia, East Asia, in the Middle East, in Africa, even in Latin America and parts of Eastern Europe, not Western Europe,
right.
The projection is that middle-class consumption will go up big time. So this is something that puts us at a relative disadvantage. But as was mentioned before, there's nothing in the world like the flexibility and the ability of this economy to rebound, to look for new industries, to look for new opportunities for growth.
That's right. Your book is about the dollar, I guess the almighty dollar, and the strength of the dollar compared to other currencies. Where does that strength come from?
Well, right now, as you know, Japan and the Eurozone are thinking about relaxing the monetary policies even further. Japan just made a big announcement 10 days ago. Also, the U.S. economy is recovering faster than any of these other economies. The trade deficit in the United States, there's a reduction of that, some good news there. All of these things tend to strengthen the dollar. Plus, on top of all of that, we have turmoil in the world. Every week, I think we have to add another country to our own personal list as to countries that we need to worry about, right? All of those geopolitical frictions essentially translate into investors looking for a safe haven. And as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, the dollar, the U.S., continues to be the most important safe haven.
You want to add to that, Ishwar?
Yes, Mauro basically took the words
no, I had a
out
feeling
of my
he
mouth.
Did, but yeah, go ahead.
In a sense, right now, the cyclical conditions across the major advanced economies certainly favor the U.S. because the U.S. is thinking about when it's going to tighten monetary policy because it's far ahead in terms of where its business cycle conditions are. And the other issue, which I point out in my book, is that whenever there is turmoil anywhere in the world, the reality is that people still look to the U.S. dollar as the ultimate safe haven currency. Now, that does not necessarily mean that the U.S. is in an extraordinarily strong position. But in international finance, ultimately, everything is relative. And as one looks around the world for reasonably bright spots, I think the U.S. is where most of the investors still come looking for safety. Certainly not yield at the moment, given how low interest rates are. But anytime there is turmoil, what investors really care most about is safety. And also liquidity, the ability to use that cash fairly quickly if they need it. And the U.S. government bond market provides that in a way that virtually no other market can.
To you, Ishwar, though, and you use the word turmoil, when you look or others look at Europe and there are some problems with the Eurozone, does that fall under the definition of turmoil?
That certainly adds to global uncertainty and perceptions about worldwide risk because the European economy is, after all, pretty close in size to that of the U.S. economy. China is catching up but still has a ways to go. So if you think about where investors could park their money in order to find safety, there really isn't much of an alternative to the U.S. Now, the interesting paradox is that every time we've had turmoil, not just in the Eurozone or in emerging markets, but even in the U.S. itself, for instance, when there was a downgrading of U.S. government debt or when the U.S. was close to at least a technical default on its debt because of the debt ceiling negotiations, on those occasions as well, somewhat paradoxically, people came to the U.S. dollar in search for safety from the turmoil that the U.S. itself was creating. And that, in a sense, is the ultimate paradox. So the U.S. causes turmoil, and people come to the U.S. for safety from that turmoil.
Which makes absolutely no sense, Moore. I'm looking at you.
No, but I have to agree. This essentially happened in 2009 and 2010. And again, as mentioned, everything is relative.
Yeah.
And although not everything is going okay here in the United States, relative to other parts of the world, to other economies, to other currencies, things are reasonably okay.
So what's the struggle in Europe over the euro? And there I realize it's a complicated system, but as you boil it down, what's the issue there?
Well, the issue there essentially is that we have a 18 economies that a number of years ago, in 1999, entered into monetary union. But this is a collection of very different economies, some of them very competitive, others not so much. And essentially it's very difficult then to, under conditions of stress in the global economy, to hold all of these economies together. Mm. And what we see is divergence in Europe over the last 5 years. And we see, of course, big problems with the banking system, big problems with government debt, excessive government debt, and a reluctance on the part of Europeans, I think, in general, to bite the bullet and to come up with a solution that goes beyond the austerity measures, which eventually may work, but they're truly causing quite a bit of hardship throughout Europe.
This goes back a couple of years, but this country and other countries were dealing with the high rate of unemployment caused by the financial crisis. And I remember doing an interview about Germany, which, part of the policy was not to lay off people wholesale, but to sort of downsize, maybe make them work 4 days a week as opposed to 5 days a week, thereby having less disruption within their own economy. Do you know if that was a smart thing for them to do?
No, absolutely. Germany, along with other European countries in Central Europe and Northern Europe, they have a set of institutions in place, and they have a culture. They have a way of, making policy that oftentimes have gotten them into trouble. I don't want to say that they've always been right. But I think that they'd, navigated the global turmoil in 08, 09, 2010 extremely well. And now unemployment in Germany is, around 5%. The economy is doing reasonably well. It hasn't entered a recession. And it is an example, I think, for the rest of Europe. But they need to do more to pull the periphery, the southern European countries, out of their own problem.
Israel, let me turn back to you. And picking up on this word austerity, I mean, would it be fair to say, looking at Europe, that if that's an experiment in austerity, it has not worked?
The fundamental problem in Europe was that they were trying to do two very difficult things at the same time. One is to deal with a very large fiscal problem because many of these countries had built up large levels of debt that was becoming unsustainable. But the second and more important issue for many of these economies was really how to restore their competitiveness. Germany, one of the core economies, had undertaken some of these difficult reforms in the early 2000s, but many of the economies that did get into trouble during the Eurozone debt crisis were the ones that had let their competitiveness lag. And the difficulty in undertaking these reforms to make your economy more competitive, things like reforms to make businesses more competitive, the labor market more competitive by making it easier to hire and to fire workers, all of that becomes much harder when you're also trying to tighten the belt at the same time. Because invariably, these reforms do have significant dislocation costs. So Europe was forced at some level to deal with austerity, and now they are reconsidering whether they should get the ordering a little different. But even if they do ease the brakes on the austerity, the big question is whether these economies can really restore their competitiveness by doing what really needs to be done, which is fixing their labor and product markets, and to some extent also the financial system, especially the banks in Europe.
That would be the European Central Bank go ahead, Mauro.
No, I think that would be the banking system, which is, I think Eswar was about to say that essentially there's very little lending, especially to small and medium-sized enterprises throughout the Eurozone right now. This is the biggest problem that they have. And without that lending, there's not going to be a lot of, job creation, unfortunately.
If people aren't lending money and helping to start business and all of that. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Mauro Guillen and Eswar Prasad. And we are talking about the global economy. And although you may not believe it, the U.S. is considered a bright star, certainly when compared to a number of other countries. We are breaking this all down, putting it all back together, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the twists and turns of the global economy, why the U.S. is actually recovering and in better shape while other countries are still struggling, and what this all means for average Americans. Our guests are Mauro Guillen. He's director of the Joseph H. Lauder Institute at Penn, also a professor in international management at the Wharton School and co-author of a book called Global Turning Points. Eswar Prasad is a professor of trade policy Policy at Cornell University, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. In fact, joins us from the studios of Brookings. And his book is called The Dollar Trap, How the U.S. Dollar Tightened Its Grip on Global Finance. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Maura, I'm sure some people listening to us are saying, well, who cares? I mean, who cares what's happening in Western Europe or Eastern Europe or China or Russia or Japan, for that matter? Why should we care?
Well, we should care because the U.S. is an export-oriented economy, at least to a certain extent, and because our own well-being over the long run depends on how the rest of the world does. We have a lot of stake in terms of our own personal, you know, individual family well-being in terms of what's going on in the rest of the global economy. In this integrated world, you know, this turmoil, these things that are not going exactly very well in other parts of the world will eventually hit us.
Mm. I'm looking at something that Jack Lew said, Treasury Secretary. He says the world cannot afford a European lost decade. To you, Eshwar, do you think that's what we're looking at when you look at some of the economic financial challenges in Western Europe?
We do live in a much more integrated world economy. So much as we might like to think the U.S. Can get along, even irrespective of what happens in the rest of the world, that's not quite right. Now, the U.S. Exports account for about around 15% of GDP, which may not seem like a large amount, but the exporting sector does tend to be pretty good at generating relatively high-wage jobs, and that's where a lot of growth at the margin tends to come from. But more importantly, it's very hard to envision the U.S., which now accounts for a much smaller share of the world economy than it used to even a decade ago, managing to pull the rest of the world along. So if the rest of the world starts looking to the U.S. consumers in particular to pull them out of their own recessions, it's going to be very difficult for the U.S. to sustain its own recovery. So my sense is that if we see weaknesses in the rest of the world, it'll have some short-term benefits. The dollar will remain strong, so our imports will be cheaper for the U.S., which will keep inflation down here. Money coming into the U.S. is going to keep interest rates down. But all of this could well be counterbalanced by the fact that the U.S. will not be able to export as much, and the dollar remaining strong means that our exports will be somewhat less competitive. So my concern, which is similar to that of Mauro, is that although the U.S. so far has had a self-sustaining recovery that seems to have some momentum at least, this momentum could very easily tip over and have the economy slow down if the rest of the world starts being a drag on the U.S. economy itself.
Well, and going back to you, Mauro Guillen, and thinking about the income inequality in this country, which has grown in recent years, are we seeing something parallel to that in, for instance, Western Europe?
Yes, absolutely. So over the last 10 years or so, most measures of income inequality in a large number of countries in Western Europe have also taken a turn for the worse.
And, for the same reasons as the U.S., you think?
Well, yes. I mean, mostly technological change, to a certain extent, the impact of trade, and obviously, you know, unemployment and underemployment as the other issue in Europe. Let's not forget that in the young age group, we have, you know, no more than 50% of those people essentially employed in the formal sector. I mean, the rest is unemployed or underemployed in some way or another. So, yeah, this is also another problem that is, you know, adding to the political issues in Europe emerging and making it harder to adjust. But it's also, I think, slowing down the rate of recovery.
Well, and we think of a number of European countries having a more, let's say, well-constructed safety net than in this country. Has that safety net been frayed by all these economic financial challenges?
Well, it has had several effects. I mean, one, of course, it has made the impact on people much less, you know, harsh than in other parts of the world, to be sure. But it has also added to the government's stock of debt, right? Because the government has made those commitments. You know, it kind of, on the one hand, helps ameliorate the situation, but on the other, it does make it harder for these governments to get out of the of this big problem that they have, which is that they've accumulated way too much debt.
Eshwar Prasad, is there something the U.S. can do that it's not doing to help these other countries, or is it everybody for themselves these days?
The U.S., I think, just by the strength of its own economy, does help other countries because we do run a trade deficit still, which means that we import a little more than we export. Deficit has gone down over time, but still the U.S. is still seen as an important driver of global growth. But other than that, really, what these economies could perhaps learn from the U.S. is how one needs to be relatively aggressive in terms of both monetary and fiscal policy in order to put the economy back on track in the short run, and to think about having a relatively flexible economy in the long run. So I guess the best the U.S. can do really is continue leading by example. Not that the U.S. has gotten everything right, but it has certainly gotten some things more right than the other advanced economies, which have been somewhat timid in terms of using their policy instruments full bore in order to get their economies back on track, at least from the point of view of the business cycle.
Do you think the stimulus, such as it was the right thing to do, Eshwar?
If you mean the U.S. stimulus,
yes.
Initially we had both very large fiscal stimulus in terms of government spending and also monetary policy stimulus in terms of easy money. We then started reversing course a little bit on fiscal stimulus, that there was in fact a withdrawal of fiscal stimulus, which I think was somewhat premature, while the central bank continued, the Fed, that is, continued to maintain easy money policies, and it's just beginning to pull back on those. In both Japan and Europe, there was something of a reluctance to use monetary policy as aggressively, and is sort of coming to the party a little late. There are certainly a lot of risks from using easy money policy, and it is certainly not the solution. And I think the one lesson we need to take from this crisis is that monetary policy can be a very effective instrument if it is supported by other policies, by structural reforms, and by fiscal policy. The problem is that in most of the world, we have these policies not working in tandem, and central banks essentially becoming the first and last line of defense. And that's not good for the countries involved or for the world economy.
To you, Morgan, and you had mentioned Eastern Europe in a slightly different situation than Western Europe. Why is that?
Well, it's the emerging part of Europe. These are economies that are very clearly operating well below their potential. And they have everything to gain from associating themselves with a larger trade bloc. They're also in learning mode. This is very important. They're learning from the U.S. They're learning from their European partners now. And they have, relatively speaking, younger populations than some of the other Western European countries. And so the projections are that this part of the world, I'm talking about Poland, the Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Romania, Slovenia, and so on, they're going to be doing much better, even if the European malaise continues, right, for another 5 or 10 years. They're going to be doing much better. And the projections are that, consumer markets there are taking off. And, I think there are brighter days ahead for Eastern Europe, absolutely.
Let me reintroduce the two of you. That's Mauro Guillen, director of the Joseph H. Lauder Institute at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us, Eshwar Prasad, and he's a professor of trade policy at Cornell University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. We are talking about the global economy. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get, looks like Warren from Gwynedd Valley to join us on Radio Times. Warren, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty. Good to talk to you, as always.
Thanks.
I have 2 points to make with your experts. One is if they could talk a little bit about the problem with shadow banking in many countries. Greece comes to mind as an example that's been brought up before. And my second point is if your experts could talk about the loss of these Middle Eastern countries with the wars going on, where massive trade that used to exist is, in, I guess, extinct with these wars and turmoil going on.
Warren, two good questions. And perhaps I'll put the first one to you, Eshwar Prasad, which is about shadow banking. Can you respond to that?
Now, shadow banking does have this very sinister air about it, but it means very different things in very different countries. Essentially, it's the part of the banking system that is not under the formal regulatory arm. So it includes hedge funds, private equity funds, and a variety of other actors. Now, the question is whether the shadow banking creates problems that can bring down an entire financial system. In the U.S., in fact, it was the investment banks that ran into a lot of trouble. And one might argue that it was parts of their own activities that might counter shadow banking that created the real problems. But it's the banks that are fundamentally at some level very fragile because they are trying to do something which serves an economy well, that is take short-term savings and intermediate them into productive long-term investments. But the problem is that we had incentives that were very largely skewed and we are still dealing with the effects of inadequate regulation. In other countries, China, for instance, shadow banking is a much bigger beast, and at some level it provides some competition for the domestic banking system. So we shouldn't tar, quote-unquote, shadow banking with too broad a brush, but there is certainly no question that regulating more effectively both the formal and informal parts of the banking system is going to be very important to ensure financial stability and make sure that what we saw 6 years ago doesn't happen again.
To you, Mauro, this is about unrest. I mean, in Middle East, there, lots of parts of the world, there is unrest. But specifically, Warren's question about the Middle East, how do you see that playing out?
Well, the obviously, the Arab Spring and all of the latest developments in that part of the world are creating a lot of uncertainty. This is a part of the world, let's not forget, that has very young populations, that is strategically located in terms of the shipping lanes, you know, Egypt, the Suez Canal, that is home to, you know, vast natural resources, especially fossil fuels. So instability in this area is tremendously important. And we haven't yet figured out how to make transitions, political transitions in that part of the world. And let's keep in mind that, you know, the only stable parts of that region so far are the monarchies. Right, so Morocco, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, maybe that's a solution, but it's not a solution that is easily transplanted to other parts, right? And as an interesting phenomenon, by the way, this morning we saw that the Islamic State, which is, of course, now enemy number one, has announced that they're introducing their own currency, right? Well, which is, of course, a symbolic step, I think, at first. They want to be a stable entity. I don't think this kind of an announcement is a good sign, right? I mean, they really want to consolidate their positions.
But it seems a monarchy in the 21st century, that just seems, you know, something so medieval. I mean, don't we have to do better than having monarchies?
Absolutely. But just imagine if the monarchies in the region, right, you know, from Morocco to the west, all the way to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states to the east, if they weren't there, the problem would be right now much worse than what it is. And I'm not saying that these political regimes are great. There's repression. There's a lack of democratic freedoms and so on and so forth.
Indeed.
But at the very least, there's stability.
Well, let me go back to you, Eshwar, and even going back to the fact that oil prices are now, I think, what is it, $80 a barrel of oil. How is that playing out? I'm thinking of Russia in particular, but obviously other countries' economies so dependent on fossil fuels. How is that affecting the world economy?
It's a very mixed bag. It's certainly true that the oil exporting countries, Russia, the Middle Eastern countries and so forth, even Latin American countries like Venezuela, are going to have a very difficult economic time if crude oil stays at about $80 per barrel. These countries' fiscal positions, their economic systems are going to come under severe stress. But on the other hand, there are many economies around the world that do benefit from lower oil prices, the U.S. economy being a case in point, but also emerging market economies like India that import a lot of oil. But the bigger question is why this is happening, and there are two concerns here. One is the rising geopolitical uncertainties, including in the Middle East, which are not good for world growth or consumer and business confidence. That is one problem, and that is feeding into weaker world demand for commodities, including oil. So I think although weaker oil prices and especially cheaper gas prices at the pump are a nice thing, the reason they're happening is not a very good reason because it suggests weaknesses in a large part of the world economy combined with geopolitical uncertainties that are not good for a durable world economic recovery.
Well, and I'm thinking about Russia, of course, with the crisis in the Ukraine, the sanctions against Russia, a country so dependent on oil for its economy. And I'm looking at you, Mauro. How does Russia fit into our conversation?
Well, Russia is one of these, you know, 50-odd countries in the world that are formally democracies, but de facto, in practice, it's a dictatorship, really. You know, every 4 years the president gets validation, you know, at the polls, but it's a sham. And Russia has, I think, taken a very, very dangerous path in terms of its relationship with the rest of the world. It's even, you know, aggressively, you know, from a military point of view, pointing at Western Europe beyond Ukraine, right? And even the United States. There were some reports this week about Russian planes. So it is a regime right now that needs to be confronted.
The Europeans,
well, confronted in many ways, and I think... you know, the embargo is having some effects. The freezing of assets is having some effects. The relatively low price of oil is certainly having a big effect. And this is why OPEC and the United States are not cutting supplies, right? This is really important. I think the motivation here is to twofold, right? I mean, it's good for the global economy at this point to have cheaper oil overall, right? That hopefully will stimulate growth. Through higher consumer spending because people will have more money to allocate to other kinds of spending. But there's also these geopolitical hotspots. And let's not forget Iran. There's also this motivation to try to deprive Iran from income at a crucial moment in terms of the negotiations regarding their nuclear program.
About a minute before a break here. This is to you, Ashwaran. This is from an email from Paolo saying he had dinner last night with a German who told me that the government used the crisis to dismantle the social safety net. They are effectively reducing income in the U.S. You need to focus on household income, and it has not budged in 40 years. Anything you want to add to that?
No, that's certainly a very unfortunate part of the U.S. economic recovery. The U.S. economy is generating 200,000-plus jobs per month on average for the last 12 months. The unemployment rate is down, but people in the middle class don't feel it.
Right.
Average wages are not – median wages are not rising in inflation-adjusted terms. They've actually fallen a little bit over the last a couple of decades. So unless we can find a way – to protect those at the lower end of the income distribution and make sure that the benefits of growth are shared more equitably, we're going to have some real concerns in terms of social and economic stability on our hands.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We are talking about the global economy, the various moving parts in the global economy. And again, that's Ashwar Prasad. He's a professor of trade policy at Cornell University, author of a book called The Dollar Trap, How the U.S. Dollar Tightened Its Grip on Global Finance. Also with us, Mauro Guillen, director of the Joseph H. Lauder Institute at the University of Pennsylvania, co-author of a book called Global Turning Points. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We do want to talk about China and Japan as we march across the world in our conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and even though you may not be feeling it, the U.S. is in better economic shape compared to a lot of other countries in the world when you measure for things like GDP and employment and the strength of the country's currency. But the question is, can the U.S. maintain its current status if the rest of the world is struggling? And that's what we're talking about with our guests, Mauro Guillen and Ashwar Prasad. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Well, let's talk a little bit about, I can't decide between China or Japan. Let's do Japan. This is a country who's actually losing population, and its economy, as I understand it, is really kind of shrinking. What do we need to know about Japan?
Well, Japan, as we all know, was a very competitive economy back in the 60s, the 70s, into the 80s. Back in the 80s, nobody was talking about China. People were talking about Japan and how formidable their companies were and their brands, and that we couldn't take enough Japanese-made goods.
Right.
And then something happened. They went through a bubble, and they've been going through stagnation and deflation for the last 25 years. They have an aging population, and I'm getting really worried about Japan because over the last years, few years, we've also seen their companies starting to decline, Toyota, Sony, and so on. So it's not just the economy, it's also those companies that are no longer as competitive as they once were.
And Ishwar, what I read is that Japanese people, they don't spend money, or if they do, there is a consumption tax, and that is also having an effect on their economy.
Yes, to use a technical term, Marty, Japan is in a pretty deep funk right now.
That's a term we can all relate to, yes.
The difficulty is that, as you pointed out, the economy isn't growing. There are severe pressures towards deflation, that is, prices actually falling, although prices did get a bump up because of a tax boost. Now, why in the middle of a very weak economic situation did the government raise taxes? That comes to their fiscal position. They now have a gross public debt that is about 2.5 times the amount of annual GDP. Mm. So that is a lot of debt. Now, it turns out most of it is held domestically, but Japanese people can see the consequences that that debt will have to be paid down. At some level, it's paying back to themselves. But because the economic prospects are very uncertain and because prices are likely to start falling again, what they're doing is putting off consumption, trying to save more money, which at some level becomes self-defeating because if the economy isn't growing, that money is going to essentially end up not being able to produce, provide more goods and services. So in a sense, they're caught in a very difficult trap and they don't have the tools really to get out of it, especially with a declining population and with declining competitiveness, unless they undertake some very serious reforms to bring more people, more women in particular, into the labor market, get the banking system working better, improve competition among the firms domestically. It's going to be a very hard and long road for Japan.
Do they need immigrants more?
Well, I think the first step should be to encourage and to allow more women to return to the labor force. So young women in Japan start working, but then when they marry, they withdraw from the labor force. And, you know, Japan has like 3 or 3.5% unemployment. That's not the issue. The issue is that not so many people, prepared people, educated people, actually, are willing to work and or allowed to work. So that should be one major source of growth. But, yeah, I mean, Japan is also a country that historically has been very close to immigration. And, you know, we benefit big time in the United States. I think Europe, by and large, has also benefited from immigration, right? You know, the United States attracts, you know, very bright people from all over the world. And we need labor for all sorts of industries and occupations in the United States. Japan doesn't have that ability to attract people because of its history and its culture. And it is in a very, very difficult situation now. Who would have said, you know, 25 years ago, mm-hmm. everybody was like singing the praises of Japan?
I remember that well. I mean, yeah. Are you hopeful, pessimistic about Japan?
No, I am pessimistic, although one must say that they've taken a very bold step 10 days ago in terms of monetary policy. But as Ward was saying earlier, you need to also introduce other kinds of reforms. Monetary policy cannot be the only thing that you do.
Let me get, it looks like Raj from Collegeville to join us. Raj, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
Yeah, my question is, do we have checks and balances in the U.S. financial system so the situation that occurred in 2008 does not repeat?
To you, and I'm going to put this to you, Eshwaran, and only because I was talking with Mauro during the breaks about the fact that in this country there is just so much suspicion, I should say, of our financial system, you know, the feeling that did we really fix what imploded in 2008? And I think that's what Raj is really asking. Do we have enough checks and balances so we don't repeat what happened back then?
So it is, I think, plausible to take a very skeptical view about reforms that have been undertaken, but I have a slightly more positive view. I think the financial system is safer than the situation in 2007. We are asking banks to hold more capital, that is, more buffers that will prevent them from having to shut down if they start experiencing some losses on their asset portfolios. There are some measures to separate out core banking functions from the more speculative sort of functions that banks were undertaking before the crisis. So all of that is to the good, but we still haven't solved some fundamental problems in terms of incentives for taking risk. And although the problem of too big to fail is being alleviated to some extent by asking the bigger banks to hold even more safety buffers in the form of higher capital requirements, I still think the incentives are rather distorted. And there is a whole unregulated part of the banking system, the shadow banking system that was referred to earlier, where some of these risks might start pooling. So I think we are safer. I don't think we will have the sort of meltdown we saw in 2008. But there are, I think, legitimate questions about whether the incentives have been fixed, whether we have enough effective regulation from preventing at least small-scale financial problems from coming out in the coming years.
You want to add to that, Maura? No? Okay. Let me get to, it looks like Ariel from Ardmore to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Ariel. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
What I wanted to ask is, I have a family in Germany and in Israel, and I was wondering if, and I see that the individual's financial life and quality of life is much better than the one in the U.S., and I was wondering if the bottom line is really the most important thing and not the individual quality of life of people.
Ariel, thanks for the call to Radio Times. A very philosophical question, but I think an important one while we're talking dollars and cents here, Maroki.
No, I love your question, Ariel. I think it's a terrific question. And there's a lot of debate as to whether we should measure personal well-being or, you know, the well-being
happiness
of the family
or
happiness just in terms of, GDP per capita, income per capita. I think different people come down on that question from, different perspectives. I think we all have different cultural expectations as to how much we would want to accomplish in life. I do believe, though, that in general, it is better to be a citizen of a country like Germany or the United States or Denmark or even Japan these days, right, than it is to be a citizen on average of other countries that are having more trouble developing. This is very clear. But I would agree that, I think governments should, set their sight not just on GDP growth, but also on, improving the daily lives of their citizens in other ways. And I do believe that countries such as Germany, as you pointed out, do a terrific job in terms of, helping their populations, conduct themselves in a way that is good for the environment, is good for themselves, is good for the long-term stability of their societies. I'm afraid I don't know enough about Israel, although I visited twice, to make a comment about it. But once again, I think you're putting your finger on an extremely important issue.
Do you want to add to that, Ishwar?
No, this is a very legitimate concern. As you pointed out, Marty, if you look at the top-line indicators like GDP, employment, unemployment, the U.S. economy looks like it's doing great. But those at the bottom half of the income distribution, especially those in the top bottom 10% or so, are really not seeing any of the benefits. And while the economy may be doing well, if a large portion of the population is worried about health care, is worried about economic insecurity that it faces, and there are no effective social safety nets, that's not a good quality of life economically or psychologically for a large part of the population. So I think we need to take a serious look about societal choices that we make about how effectively all of this economic growth translates into better quality of life, not just per capita income, as Mauro had pointed out, for a large segment of the population.
Mm. Well, and Mauro, you were telling me before the show began that you anticipate a pretty dramatic change, not the world that's going to end, but perhaps the world as we know it, 2025 to 2030. What do you see as you look in your crystal ball?
Well, because we have, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think if we, extrapolate into the future with some, reasonable models, what's going on right now in terms of the demography, population trends, in terms of the rise of the middle class in emerging markets, in terms of, this geopolitical turmoil, just in terms of some of the topics that we've, been discussing today, that the U.S. is no longer as large an economy in the global context as it once was, and so on and so forth, then, it's only going to take about 15 years, tops 20 years from today, to be in a world in which China and India will be the largest consumption markets in the world. A world in which the dollar will not be the only safe haven. There will be other currencies coexisting with the dollar, although the dollar might continue to be the most important currency in an international context.
But it's going to have some competition, you're
yes,
saying.
Yes, and a world in which we're going to have, in many countries around the world, more grandparents and grandchildren. And that's a world that we've never been in, right? A world in which we have, a significant proportion of the population above the age of 50 or 55. That's a very different world from the one in which I was born, in any case.
Let me go back to you, Ishwar. We haven't really talked about China, the big elephant in the room here. President Obama, obviously, just in China recently. How do you see, then, talking about this global economy, and even just from what Mauro just said, what role do you see China playing, I guess, today and as you look into the future?
China is certainly the key economic heavyweight right now. If you look at the amount of contribution to world economic growth since the global financial crisis, China is adding more to global GDP than even the U.S. because it's a smaller economy than the U.S., although catching up fast, but it is growing much more rapidly. And when we talk about a growth slowdown in China, we're talking about growth slowing down from 10 or 11% a few years ago to 7% now. They face a lot of domestic challenges. Mm. Their labor force also is beginning to shrink. But they are very effectively using government policies to start boosting their more competitive and high productivity sectors. They are trying to reallocate labor from rural areas to urban areas. They are trying to reform their financial system. So it's an economy that is beset by a huge amount of inefficiencies and weaknesses. But as I speak to Chinese officials, what impresses me is their desire to do the right thing, at least on the economic front. It's fairly clear that broader legal or political reforms are pretty much off the cards. But in terms of economic policy, they do seem very determined. The problem, again, is that this is an economy that's going to become perhaps the largest in the world in its current growth trajectory, but will still, at that point, have a per capita income that is only about one-fifth or one-sixth that of the United States. So they face a lot of developmental challenges, but they seem to be going about it at least with the right intentions in mind.
Well, and they have some environmental challenges, it seems more. I know they had to kind of turn off their industry when Obama and others were meeting in Beijing just to clear the skies.
Yeah, absolutely. Water quality and air quality, I think, are the most immediate concerns of the Chinese population, especially in the urban areas these days. And there's a lot of political pressure in China to try to address those problems. And the recent agreement in terms of reducing emissions, you know, by the year 2030, I think, is part of that process by which the Chinese population is putting a lot of pressure on the leadership.
I'm looking actually at my screen here. We have Jeremy, probably won't get to his call, but he's calling us from Downingtown. He wants to know the effect of Bitcoin on the global economy. Can I put that to you, Eshwar?
So Bitcoin, I think, may not last, although I've been wrong about many other things in the past. It's probably not a barrier to get a couple of Bitcoins because in the next 5 years or so, it's either going to be worth nothing or it's going to be worth a lot of money. But what Bitcoin has really, I think, been very important in showing us is the way that we can use certain types of algorithms in order to set up electronic payment systems. So I think the way we think about money, the way we transact, conduct financial transactions, is going to change a lot. And Bitcoin technology, I think, has been very important in that sense. Now, ultimately, the problem is that you need some notion of trust to back a currency, not just in its function as an intermediating currency for financial transactions, but as a store of value. And the question is whether something that is as decentralized as Bitcoin will ever really become a viable source of store of value. And I think for that, Bitcoin or any of its electronic counterparts are going to have a long way to go because they don't have backings of governments behind them.
Mauro, do you agree, disagree?
I think I largely agree. I mean, we're experimenting. We're trying to learn how to use digital money. I strongly agree with the possibility that at some point these digital currencies or a digital currency may become a store of value, may even become a reserve currency, which would help us overcome some important issues in the global financial architecture as to for how long can we rely on the dollar, for how long or how early, how soon can the renminbi, the Chinese currency, be part of the you know, the global financial architecture on an equal basis, and so on and so forth. So these are tantalizing possibilities. I think it is no longer science fiction, but we need to experiment with that over the next you know, few years to learn more about.
Well, we have covered a lot of territory. I learned a lot. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Eshwar Prasad, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Marty. It's been a pleasure, and pleasure talking with you as well, Mauro.
I know you two know of each other. It's always nice to bring people together. I should add, Eshwar Prasad is a professor of trade policy at Cornell University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, joined us from Brookings. He's also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, wrote a book called The Dollar Trap. Mauro Guillen, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And he's director of the Joseph H. Lauder Institute at the University of Pennsylvania, also a professor in international management at the World Wharton School and co-authored a book called Global Turning Points. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us, and do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.